I've lived in Washington now for 44 years, and that's a lot of folly to witness.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Matt Welch, and we're talking today with George Will, the Washington Post columnist, This Week panelist, and author of many books, including Statecraft of Soulcraft, What Government Does, Men at Work, The Craft of Baseball, and most recently, One Man's America, The Pleasures and Provocations of Our Singular Nation. Born in 1941 and raised in the college environs of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, Will holds a PhD in political science from Princeton, a school once operated by one of the very worst of all American presidents, Woodrow Wilson, and his dissertation was titled Beyond the Reach of Majorities, Closed Questions in the Open Society. We're going to ask you tough questions about your dissertation later. A former staffer for Colorado Republican Senator Gordon Allett, he has taught politics at Michigan State, worked at National Review, and received a Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 1977. The Wall Street Journal has called him perhaps the most powerful journalist in America, and he has the distinction of having been attacked as a pseudo-intellectual in the pages of Doonesbury, back when people actually still read that comic strip, and of having been praised by Kramer on Seinfeld, not for his intelligence, but for his clean, scrubbed look. Welcome, George Will.
Thank you. It's the first time my children ever took me seriously.
I can imagine.
Appeared in Seinfeld. I think Kramer said I was cute.
Yes, he liked your appearance very much, but not your brain. So in 2011, you discussed in your Washington Post column a rather obscure tract called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America, and you wrote, "These incurably upbeat journalists with Reason magazine believe that not even government, try as it will, can prevent onrushing social improvement. America," you continued, "is moving in the libertarians' direction, not because they have won an argument, but because government and the sectors it dominates have made themselves ludicrous. This has opened minds to the libertarian argument." Is it correct to say that you yourself, over the years, are inclining more in a libertarian direction as well?
Yes, for several reasons. The first is that I've lived in Washington now for 44 years, and that's a lot of folly to witness up close. And whatever confidence and optimism one felt toward the central government when I got here on January 1st, 1970, is pretty much dissipated at the hands of the government. Second, I participate, although I'm 72 and too old to learn very much, I do participate in the changing technological assumptions. I'll give you an example. When I was growing up and I wanted to hear the songs of the day, Bill Haley and the Comets and the Platters and all that stuff, I would turn on the radio and hope that the disc jockey I was listening to would play three or four of the songs I wanted to hear in the next hour. My daughter and other children want to hear their songs, they just go to the internet and they have 50,000. When I wanted a cup of coffee, I went to a coffee shop and ordered a cup of coffee. Now you go to a Starbucks or somewhere and you have a mind-boggling number of choices. And choice just seems more natural, more built into the social environment.
So what does that have to do with government, though, or your assumptions about government?
Well, first of all, government operates on one size fits all, because that suits the bureaucratic method and impulse, which is empire building and a manifest destiny on the part of every bureaucracy to maximize its mission. You can see it in everything from the Secret Service, no president can be safe enough, to Obamacare.
You have said previously that John McCain was kind of helpful in your evolution in a more libertarian direction. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the McCain-Feingold law did something that it never occurred to me even Congress would have the audacity and effrontery to do, or that the Supreme Court would ratify, which it largely did at first. And that is, Congress, which is to say incumbent legislators, passed laws limiting the content, timing, and quantity of political speech about incumbent legislators. And this passed, which shouldn't have surprised me, but it did, and was, as I say, ratified by the Supreme Court.
So that was kind of the final moment, right? Your Kronstadt moment or something where you gave up completely on
large government as an instrument of...
That was part of it. I also, I'm a reader, and I read Mansur Olson, mm-hmm. and I read Jonathan Rauch's Demosclerosis, where he applied some of Olson's insights about how interest groups fasten like barnacles on a ship of state and eventually immobilize the ship and make reform almost impossible.
Let's talk about this in context of Statecraft to Soulcraft, which was published in 83, and it was kind of, I mean, you had been in the public eye for a decade or more, but this was kind of a big statement. And among other things, you wrote caustically of the differences, or actually the similarities between liberals and conservatives at the time, and you were talking about people like FDR and Ronald Reagan. You wrote, "I will do many things for my country, but I will not pretend that the careers of, say, Ronald Reagan and Franklin Roosevelt involve serious philosophical differences." Specifically, you faulted both groups for believing that the inner life of citizens are, and you talked about, our sentiments, manners, and moral opinions were none of the government's business. So you were saying that Ronald Reagan meant it when he said that he was an FDR Democrat, and that the problem with them is that they left people alone too much?
No. What Ronald Reagan said, "I'm an FDR Democrat, not a Great Society Lyndon Johnson Democrat." That Ronald Reagan never assaulted, never promised to assault in any fundamental way, the social safety net. It was when government got into the business of saying who should live where, who should think what, the Great Society agenda of comprehensive social engineering, that Reagan got off the bandwagon. Statecraft to Soulcraft, read by dozens, began as the Godkin Lectures at Harvard in three lectures in 1981. The subtitle is What Government Does, not what government should do, but what government cannot help but do. Any regime, by its structure of laws, is affirming certain values and discouraging certain vices. If you have a free market, laissez-faire society, a market society affirms certain values: choice, freedom, self-reliance, sanctity of contract, promise-keeping, all the rest. And therefore, when you choose your regime, you are choosing to affirm and nurture and encourage a certain character. That's why what I said is government cannot not be in any business other than the Soulcraft business.
Do you still believe that?
I do, and I think you do too.
Well, let me ask, because in the column that you had written about our book, The Declaration of Independence, you noted, the essence of libertarian political thought is the commonsensical principle that before government interferes with the freedom of the individual and of individuals making consensual transactions in markets, it ought to have a defensible reason for doing so. It usually does not. Now, you're just talking about McCain-Feingold, the entitlement state. You've been an arch critic of things like Medicare and Social Security. You are against war in Syria. You became a critic of the Iraq invasion. I mean, the beads are piling up where you say, okay, government can't do these things right. Where are some places that the government still should be limiting human interaction? Or where is it defensible to say, no, actually, people can't do this?
Fewer and fewer, as you say. Obviously, there are neighborhood effects of pollution, neighborhood effects of noise, neighborhood effects of all sorts. Where the government goes astray is when the government decides that it is going to allocate wealth and opportunity. And that's almost entirely what the government does nowadays. The tax code, for example, Chairman Dave Camp of Michigan, Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, says the tax code is longer than the Bible without the good news, because it is entirely rent-seeking. It is more than the appropriations process. The tax code is how the government allocates favors. And we reach a point, and this is sort of a systemically important point in why I go to the tax code, we may have reached a point where the tax code is so complicated it cannot be reformed. That is, because if you say, let's start over, as Camp and Baucus have tried to do, they said, okay, we're going to have a blank slate. We're going to wipe out all the exemptions, credits, deductions, all the rest, and it's up to you people to defend them, and we'll put them back in. The problem is if you start with a blank slate, you're not picking one fight with every American, you're picking five fights with every American, and the system can't handle it. You get just so overloaded.
To go back to that kind of Mansour-Olson or demosclerosis model, is it impossible then to separate the barnacles from the hull? And are we just going down? You know, I mean, are we sinking? Or how do you, what do you do next?
We're not sinking, we're slowing down. Yeah. That is, it gets very hard to move the ship. And it slows down in terms of economic growth because you're allocating wealth and opportunity in political rather than efficient ways. And this has cumulatively a terrific drag on economic growth.
The sort of the philosophical basis of statecraft, the soulcraft, what we were talking about just earlier, could be seen, couldn't it, as, okay, government is an instrument of morality. And once people, politicians and commentators, have that feeling, then that helps the removal of limitations. Yes. In the LBJ way. I saw David Brooks, I think, was citing statecraft to soulcraft the other day as one of his periodic jeremiads against libertarianism.
Yes.
So how do you square those kind of impulses?
Well, here's how. Strict, pure libertarians say, because the government can back its tastes with the police power, it shouldn't have tastes. The argument of statecraft to soulcraft is that's all very well, but again, what government does? Government is going to have laws. It's going to legalize certain things, prescribe certain things, encourage certain things. You have to pick. You have to choose. Unless you have the most severe sort of night watchman state, and we're not going to have that.
By the way, by severe, you mean totally freaking awesome.
Right. Yeah, well, mean that. But it's not going to happen. I mean, I wrote the other day that if we could tax Americans' cognitive dissonance, we could balance the budget. The American people want all kinds of incompatible things. They're human beings. And they want a high services, low tax, omnipresent, omniprovident, cheap welfare state.
Do they get that in a place like Texas? There's a new book out by Erica Grider, which is pretty interesting. She's a liberal who writes for Texas Monthly or the Texas Observer. And she talks about how, you know, Texas, as opposed to California, is essentially that. It's low tax, low service, high opportunity. It's not a libertarian state, but doesn't Texas show that actually maybe Americans would settle for some, you know, is the vision of the country between California and Texas? And Texas is winning right now.
This is why we have federalism. There are two reasons to have federalism. First, you're more apt to have three or four or five smart governors than you are to have a smart president at any time. So you disperse decision making and experimenting. Beyond that, Texas, we can now practice under federalism what the late Daniel Boorstin, great historian and librarian of Congress, called entrepreneurial federalism. That is, let the states compete for mobile businesses. Boorstin has a wonderful essay on this in one of his three volumes of his history called The Americans. He said it started with divorce. That Indiana said we're going to have easier divorces than anyone else. And then the Dakota said, no, we're going to have Dakota divorcees. And finally, Nevada got in the act. Nevada said, look, the Comstock loads petered out. The money's gone to San Francisco. We got more sheep than people here. What can we do? And they said, we're going to have really easy divorce. And by the way, while you're here waiting the 6 weeks or whatever it is, you can gamble. Hence Las Vegas, hence Reno, hence all the rest. We see this all the time. The president, Mr. Obama the other day went to Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, and gave a speech in which he said two particularly riveting things. He said, just terrible that Maytag pulled up from Illinois and went to Mexico. No one said, well, yeah, Mr. President, that's because your friends in the labor unions chased him out. A few sentences later, he says, but wonderful things are happening. Airbus is going to, the European right. consortium, going to build aircraft in Alabama. Well, why'd they go to Alabama? Because it's a right-to-work state.
Do you think somebody like Obama doesn't understand that disjuncture, or is he just kind of dissembling?
This is a man who says ATMs and airport ticket kiosks cause unemployment. Now, we had this argument a long time ago about whether or not automating the Ford plant will mean no one will be able to buy Ford cars. We've had that argument, but it hasn't percolated through to the Hyde Park section of Chicago.
Do you feel like, speaking of like that, economic arguments that we have backslid a lot, especially since the financial meltdown of 2008, refighting? People are talking about re-regulating the airlines on certain days and magazines where they used to talk about deregulating airlines. Has there been a backsliding on economic discussion in this country?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. No, I think that any American who's on the board of a school, museum, orchestra, anything with an endowment.
So you've now identified roughly 0.1%
right.
of America.
Right, but I speak for the 1%. Knows that when you have economic growth of 3% or more, everything's happy in America. When you have 2% protractedly, everything's sad in America. 1%, 1.5% makes all the difference in the world. The American political system is not used to doing what it has been doing for a decade now, and that is allocating scarcity. We're used to allocating surplus. And it's much easier to do that.
Talk about what are the roots of that, because one of the things that's interesting about your reading your work over the past several decades is you were as tough on George W. Bush as you were, as you have been on Barack Obama, or on, you know, kind of broadly based liberals and Democrats. If economic growth started slowing down in the, you know, the middle of the 21st or the first decade of the 21st century, what were the policies that Bush was pushing that helped contribute to that, or Republicans more broadly? And have they fully kind of internalized their role in this kind of scarcity America?
No, I don't think they have. Those people have internalized it who ask the simple question of every proposed policy, how does it contribute to or subtract from economic growth? That's everything now. We have an ongoing national tragedy. We're losing a generation. We have what percentage of young people are now living with their parents, from say 18 to 28, something like that.
You know, and the real tragedy is for the parents.
Tell
to
me
be
about
quite
it.
Honest.
Yeah, no, I've got four children. None of them live at home. I've dodged that bullet. But no, I mean the sheer waste. Mm-hmm. You began by quoting me saying about how hard it is for government to stop innovation and growth. The American people are prodigies at wealth creation. It's hard to stop them. We're industrious, educated. We have continental market. We're mobile people. If things aren't working in Michigan, we move to Texas. Yet still, the cumulative weight of lots of little policies.
So what were some of those policies in particular that Bush or the Republicans kind of layered on top of the cake?
Well, first of all, the regulations. I was asked to come up and talk to the House members about 2 years ago, and they said, what should we do? I said, first of all, pledge you will not publish the Federal Register. Not going to do it anymore. Not going to have any more regulations. Then, and this is something that Romney endorsed and others have, any major regulation, understood as one with a $100 million impact on the economy, has to be voted on. Put their fingerprints on this. It'll really work wonders.
But that did happen with things like Dodd-Frank, more recently and in the back, Sarbanes-Oxley, the Medicare, it's not a regulation, but the Medicare prescription drug expansion.
Well, Medicare,
so, you know,
what made the Medicare prescription drug particularly pernicious and particularly Republican was that it was the first major expansion of an entitlement without a dedicated funding. They just said, well, we'll make it up as we go along. We'll borrow it from the Chinese.
Well, what's going through the Republican mind then? When they're doing something like
well,
that.
Well, in the pithy statement of Dick Cheney, Ronald Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. He didn't do any such thing, but he only proved that to Dick Cheney.
Right.
And in fact, deficits don't matter politically. The American people talk about balanced budgets. They don't care about a balanced budget at all. In fact, what deficits have done, and Reagan gets some of the demerits for this, deficits have made big government cheap. We're giving the American people a dollar's worth of government, charging them
about
65 cents for,
yeah.
And the American people say, oh, we can live with that.
There's a new generation of politicians who are arising that actually do talk about this stuff. Justin Amash, Rand Paul, They talk about actually cutting government and tackling this problem. They try to win elections.
And these are the people that you were speaking of when you said a couple months ago that the most interesting thing in American politics since last fall's election was the Republican Party getting more interesting.
Becoming more heterodox on foreign policy and domestic policy, yes.
Talk about that. What do you find interesting about these guys?
Well, first of all, they begin with a principle, the one you basically read me enunciating, which is before, it's not a radical principle, it says before the government interferes with freedom or privacy, it ought to have a compelling reason. That's all. Just tell me your reason. When you start like that, all kinds of things happen, because 98% of what government does, it does for factions, what the founders called factions, which are those who are not public-spirited, but private-spirited, who are trying to bend public power to private advantage. And if you start with that simple principle, there's no end to the times you can ask that on a given day as to what's going on in Washington.
What explains that, the appeal? And obviously, you know, the Rand Pauls, the Mike Lees, the Justin Amashes, Thomas Massies of the world, they're gaining energy and momentum, but so far they're a fraction of the Republican Party, much less the electorate. Why are they striking a chord with people? And if, in fact, you know, Americans like government on the cheap, you know, how far can they go with that?
Well, we'll see how far they can go, but this is the argument basically for a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. It's the public choice argument that the incentive to deliver benefits now and defer the costs onto the unborn and hence unconsenting future generations is irresistible. The public choice argument is powerful and gaining more strength. Why the libertarian impulse? Now, partly as the government gets bigger, it becomes more comprehensively annoying, and the annoyances add up. But beyond that, there is a great sense that Americans lost its energy. It's a kind of sagging taking over the country. That you look around and see even where we're supposed to spend money, we're not spending money. Give you an example. I traveled between Washington and New York all the time by train. I thank the people of Boise for subsidizing the Acela. I don't know why they do it, but they do it, and I appreciate it. But I don't want to live forever. I want to live long enough to go through Union Station and Penn Station where all the escalators are working at the same time. Never working at the same time.
Forever.
They are just awful, the shabby, tatty, shop-worn, down at the heel, threadbare nature of American public infrastructure.
But we shouldn't be spending money on that, right?
Yes, we should.
Who's we, Kemosabe, in that? Who's the
genuine,
we that should be?
The public should spend on genuine public goods.
And in recent columns, you've talked about things like, you talk about the sequester. Obviously, you're in favor of cutting the overall federal budget from what it is now. But you talk about, you actually are critical of the sequester for the effect it's having on, say, the National Institutes of Health.
Correct.
Lay out some of the, you know, some of the things that you think the government actually should be spending money on.
Well, I'm a Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln, Central Illinois Whig. I believe in canals, although Illinois and a lot of other states practically went broke when they plunged too enthusiastically into public works. But yes, roads. We used to be, my dear and best friend, Pat Moynihan, said we used to be a nation that celebrated people who got things done. Now we celebrate people who stop things from getting done. Pat spent most of his long career in Washington trying to get the West Side Highway changed in New York. A great potential urban scape that would be a great beauty to Manhattan. Can't get it done because there's some wretched fish in the river.
But here, I guess, is there a kind of algorithm, and I guess there isn't, but of, you know, you, if the New Deal ends up giving us the Great Society, you know, okay, then you have somebody like Ronald Reagan say, okay, I don't want the Great Society, I want the New Deal, but then he pursues policies through deficit spending that actually then jack up the Great Society. Where do you get back to a point, once you grant that, well, yeah, the West Side Highway or Amtrak should be run by the federal government?
If the New Deal of necessity had to, in the end, give us the Great Society, it is because the New Deal gave rise to a new class. not capital and labor, but regulators and regulated. That's what America's become. We're now generating enormous numbers of lawyers. Happily, there's a collapse in the law school admissions, so there may be a corrective at work here. But we have produced an enormous number of people who think they are entitled to rule, who are trained to rule, which is to say trained to administer the regulatory state. And arguably, absent the New Deal, we wouldn't have had the regulatory state, which gave rise to this class that decided it could fix Bedford-Stuyvesant.
You were talking about foreign policy earlier. This, it seems, since Reagan, and perhaps before, but definitely since Reagan, there is a Republican culture of being sort of strong and barrel-chested on defense. And then you have this kind of Justin Amash, Rand Paul wing, which is talking strikingly different about military spending and about civil liberties, about due process, and things like that. Can a modern Republican party tolerate that kind of growth of a more skeptical, humble type of foreign policy approach?
Well, it better, because along comes the president and says, well, let's have a fourth intervention in the Middle East. Let's bomb Syria. And 80% of the country says, let's not. Now, 80-20 issues don't come along that often, and you want to be on the right side of those. Remember, it was a Republican who warned against the military-industrial complex. January 1961, farewell address, Dwight Eisenhower, who knew a thing or two about war, having been in a few. Eisenhower spurned those in his cabinet, and they were loud and legion, who said, we have to help the French and Vien Phu. He said, no, we don't, actually. Kimoi Matsu, the French, British, Israeli adventure in Suez, he brought it to a halt. He just stopped it using our financial power. The Hungarian Revolution, which we perhaps improvidently encouraged, but Eisenhower said, be that as it may, that did not obligate us to intervene. We can't do it, can't get there from here. So there is a tradition of Republican restraint. And it's all the more impressive because what caused Eisenhower to take off his uniform, leave Schaeff, and run for president was the fear that the Republican Party would be taken over by Bob Taft, and Taft was too isolationist, to use the problematic term.
Although in Taft's case, that may have been accurate.
It may have been, but Eisenhower felt devoted to the alliance, to NATO, and all the rest. And so here was Eisenhower, who ran for president because he was more interventionist and internationalist than part of his party, but who still had a fairly well-developed sense of restraint.
How much, to take it down from a kind of atmosphere of rhetoric and more to political reality, how much of it is that the Republican Party became the hawkish party because they started winning the South, where a lot of military spending was done? And the Democrats have been more hawkish when they ran the South.
I don't think that's it.
Yeah.
No, I think it has more to do with the intellectuals. The party, Pat Moynihan said in about 1980, he said something momentous happened in the 1970s. The Republican Party became the party of ideas. Now, the good part of that was they were the ideas of Milton Friedman and the Mount Paul Arendt Society, the Austrian economists, Hayek, all the rest. And in foreign policy, however, they became the party of, first of all, stopping the slide in the later stages of the Cold War, which was real and dangerous. I think when the Cold War ended, I think some conservatives suffered an acute bout of 30s envy. There was a wonderful clarity to the 30s. Franco, Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, bad guys, certifiable, clear bad. They looked bad, they were bad. And they went looking for something else to give them their lives meaning. Instead of kicking back and saying, we got through the Cold War, it ended without a cataclysm, let's relax for a while.
Just this morning I was reading Bill Kristol complain with Hugh Hewitt that right now with the British Parliament voting against intervention in Syria, that we're just living through the 30s all over again.
Don't tell me. They brought up the Oxford Union vote.
Yeah.
No doubt. Okay. Well, I thought it was a stirring moment yesterday. Vote in the House. The Prime Minister gets outvoted. A shift of 7 votes would have won. And he looks across the chamber and says, the government will act accordingly.
Right. What does it say that our former monarchist overlords are showing more kind of democratic leanings on questions of war?
It shows that the Iraq syndrome, the successor to the Vietnam syndrome, may be more durable than the Vietnam syndrome was. That is, people are still getting over that. Vietnam was a mistake about nation building and about the domino effect and all the rest. But in the context of the Cold War, you can sort of understand that. What makes made the Iraq War so interesting was the clarity of the failure of intelligence. The man who must be dreading today's argument about Syria is Colin Powell. Because people are going to go back and run the guts, go to the videotape, and we're going to see him presenting in complete sincerity bad information to the United Nations.
What was the mistake, or was it a series that just kept getting worse? The intelligence was wrong that the U.S. acted on, but then the war plan. I guess the war plan was pretty successful. I mean, we were able to invade and get Baghdad very quickly. But then it's clear there was no operational plan after that, and then we just compiled more and more errors, both in Afghanistan.
Well, the head of our military establishment at the time, Don Rumsfeld, didn't want to stay there. He said, I want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, hand the keys over to the Iraqi people and leave. Well, the Iraqi people barely exist as a people. Turns out there are lots of different Iraqis. They don't like each other very much. Regime should be understood the way Aristotle did. Regime is an entire culture of politics and assumptions and values and mores and customs and dispositions. Once you understand regime that way, you begin to realize that regime change is preposterous, just as nation building is preposterous. It makes no more sense to talk about nation building than it does talk about orchid building. Orchids are organic things. So are nations, actually. That's how we got in trouble with Iraq. We thought we'd go in and change the folks behind the desk, and you would effectively change Iraq. When the Japanese government went to Admiral Yamamoto and said, could you take stealthily a fleet across the North Pacific and deliver a devastating attack on the American fleet in Hawaii, Yamamoto supposedly said, I can do that. And I will run wild in the Pacific for 6 months, maybe a year. But then what? That's the question people forget to ask. Yamamoto had lived in the United States. He loved the United States. He'd been military attaché in Washington, been to Harvard, amazingly. He still loved the United States. And he knew that what they would accomplish with Pearl Harbor is to enrage a continental superpower. And it was not going to end well, and it didn't. When we talked about regime change in Iraq, you could say, oh yeah, all Iraq needs are 3 people. They need a George Washington, a unifying figure above politics. They need a James Madison, a genius at the architecture of getting factions to live together. They need an Alexander Hamilton, who understands the political economy of a large society. And, oh, by the way, yes, they need the political culture from which such people sprang. It's that part that we neglected. We undertook regime change in our country. We did it in the American South. We started at Appomattox in April 1865, had Reconstruction, had a long lapse with Jim Crow, then with litigation, demonstrations, all the rest. We really affected regime change, as Aristotle would understand it, by the late 70s. Which
so
is
what
to
you're
say
saying is
110
too,
years.
I was going to say, you're just saying that it's too soon to issue a verdict on Iraq.
No, it's not. No, because the pressure won't be kept on them. I mean,
Now, at the same time, I mean, and the case in foreign policy, maybe it's easier to see the idea that you can just overnight rip up one, you know, take out one society or one culture and put a new one in. That also makes sense in an American context. And yet at the same time, you have increasingly kind words for the what used to be derided by conservatives as judicial activism. Why does it make sense for the Supreme Court to, or judges at various levels, to really kind of step in and say, no, this is the way we're going to do it, and to invalidate legislative decisions?
Well, first of all, someone has to say what the Constitution means, and the final arbiter. Everyone is responsible for deciding. Presidents are behaving properly when they veto legislation on constitutional grounds. So everyone's involved in this. And it used to be, until fairly recently, in American history, I'd say about the 60s, the threshold question before Congress acted was, do we have the power to act in this area with this kind of measure? James Q. Wilson, the greatest social scientist of his generation, said that the crucial moment may have been 1965 and the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Because when they passed that, the legitimacy barrier had completely fallen. There was no such thing as...
In what way?
There was no subject that it was not legitimate for the federal government to legislate about. Just gone at that point. When I was at Princeton in graduate school, 64 through 67, I was one of the earlier recipients of federal aid for graduate students. You know what it was called? National Defense Education Act. The interstate highway system was a national defense highway system. Now, they may have been stretching things. The point is there was a healthy reflex there. They said that we're attaching what we're doing to an enumerated power of the Constitution. Now, why should judges be on that? If anyone is going to vivify the theory that we have a government of limited, delegated, and enumerated powers, it will be the judges, because there's no incentive for the legislature to restrain itself. But beyond that, the threshold question is this: does America exist to preserve freedom or to implement majority rule?
And is this the, I assume that that's the theme of your dissertation, actually.
Correct. We'll get to that in just a second. The most important word in the Declaration of Independence is secure. All men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. To protect those rights, or rather, governments are instituted among men to secure those rights. Not to give us our rights. The rights pre-exist government. And governments exist to secure that which exists without their help. Governments are important to secure them, but not as fountains of rights. And that means that democracy and majority rule is valid because, and to the extent that, it protects freedom.
But then that's where the argument begins, right? Because,
correct,
for instance, you have written recently in this year critical of gay marriage, or of what we would call marriage equality. If government exists to secure certain rights and it should be treating people as individuals, why wouldn't that clearly indicate that two men or two women should be allowed to marry with all the privileges that the state secures?
Well, this argument at this point is to me highly unsatisfactory because we're arguing about the name. Mm-hmm. I mean, even people who say we want to deny the word marriage to this, we're all for civil unions with the full panoply of social rights and entitlements. So it's frankly not an argument that interests me very much, mm-hmm, other than to say that it's helped some of our liberal friends rediscover federalism. Mm-hmm. We now have blue state federalism. People say, oh, that's a good idea. Marijuana, let Colorado decide. And marriage, good, Californians, see what happens. And so it's been an educational moment for our centralizing friends.
Marijuana federalism, you wrote a couple of really interesting columns, I think, last year, talking about your own kind of rethinking of where our drug laws are, where incarceration, the kind of problem of over-incarceration in this country right now. Where are you right now when it comes to, should people be arrested for smoking pot or selling it?
Well, my first point is I want various states to try various regimes. Let's see what happens. I mean, 1 in 8 Americans lives in California. That's a big laboratory. And let's see what happens out there. And Colorado is going through all kinds of difficulties. It's unanticipated questions arise. Workplace safety, what about driving when you're using a controlled but legal substance, all the rest. Let's figure it out by having little experiments. To the extent that our drug laws are driving mass incarceration, which is a national scandal, and a huge national waste of money, and a huge assault on the social fabric, because everyone who goes to jail, almost everyone who goes to jail, is coming out, coming home, back to the neighborhood, and is not coming home improved by the experience. To the extent that the drug laws are tangled up in all the rest, they need a radical rethinking.
For me, the most interesting text that you've written in the past several years was the preface that you gave to a new Princeton University edition of Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative. One of the things you talked about in that, which I think is apropos of the current moment in conservative thought, is that you said in the early 1950s, when the conservative movement started getting cooking, that it was remarkably bookish. And there were people like T.S. Eliot, strains like that, Russell Kirk. And you said that, that these were strains that were flavored by religion, nostalgia, and resistance to the permanent revolution of conditions in a capitalist market society. And you said that had Barry Goldwater been a reading man, he would have found these forms of conservative unintelligible, even repellent. Is Barry Goldwater the model for what you are now calling conservatism?
I want more Goldwaterism in the mix.
What are the benefits, or what are the strong suits of Goldwater that are missing in today's
Republic? It's the basic skepticism about state action. Mm-hmm. It is, it's the Southwest, open horizon, multicultural society. He's a great photographer, Barry, and he loved photographing Native Americans. And he lived among people of Hispanic origin who'd been there a lot longer than the Goldwaters had been. Goldwaters came from Poland, I think. And when they got to the Southwest, they were newcomers. So he had this kind of live and let live, open spaces, a lot of sunlight, just wonderful spirit in the Southwest that I happen to love. I want more of the Goldwater impulse.
And there's also an optimism,
right? Absolutely.
A friendliness and optimism.
Absolutely.
Because it was actually kind of stunning when you said earlier that you participate in technological innovation, or you at least recognize it. At what point does that take over in terms of, why are we still talking about government? Because as long as we can go on the internet and get whatever song we want, are we wasting our time by even focusing on government?
No, because the government can be an impediment to this. We want the government to get out of the way, and we want the government to do certain kinds of research that, because of the time horizons on the research, the private sector is not going to do. Bell Labs doesn't do it anymore. Used to, maybe. Could,
and
maybe
it
should, but they're not going to.
You're in favor of, for instance, what you call basic scientific research.
Yes, I mean, I would double the NIH's budget. I'd spend more on certain things. But I visited Goldwater at his home several times. He built this home on a little bluff overlooking the valley where Phoenix is. And he said he built the home where he used to sleep at night. He'd ride his horse up and sleep at night in this little spot where his house was built. At that time, he said there were 100,000 people in the valley. Now we're approaching 4 million. Now this is a man who had to be comfortable with change and dynamism. As you know, I'm sure, the greatest hymn to capitalism ever written is in the Communist Manifesto, where Karl Marx says everything disappears into thin air. And there is, that's the European conservatives have never come to terms with that. American conservatives have. We kind of like that.
And yet, the Goldwater tendency has never really been the dominant one or the most successful one in the Republican Party. What's the opposite of Goldwaterism now? Who embodies that?
I don't see. I don't think some people say, well, there's the establishment. I don't think there is a Republican establishment. The Republican establishment's death can be dated, for the fun of it, in 1966 when the New York Herald Tribune died. There was a time when they had their newspaper. That was the Republican establishment newspaper. The Republican establishment bank was Chase Manhattan. You had Nelson and David Rockefeller. They could get to the Goldwater Convention in San Francisco in 64 and conjure a rival nominee in Bill Scranton out of thin air. There's no Republican establishment anymore, which is good.
But there are countervailing forces and figures who don't have that kind of live and let live Southwestern ethos, who don't anymore have that kind of skepticism of government. What happened? Or why did those values become ascendant in conservatism?
Well, the conservatives who are in elective office are looking over their shoulder at a deeply conflicted electorate. And again, it's the cognitive dissonance. The American people rhetorically are Jeffersonians. Operationally, they're Hamiltonians. And squaring that circle is a difficult challenge for political operatives.
Mitt Romney tried to square the circle by saying, you know, I'm a good Republican and I'm never going to tell you anything that I'm going to cut ever because I don't want to scare you. And people found him inauthentic. Right? Yeah. What did you see as him as sort of as a face of conservatism?
Well, he's not the face of conservatism. He's a Northeastern, big business, creative capitalist who wanted to govern for a while. And an honorable man, intelligent man, a man of great accomplishments, tremendous personal decency, but he wasn't a political man in the sense that he had an idea that America has serious problems that ought to be addressed.
In 2016, where do you see the choice in the country being between, and not necessarily Republican and Democrat, but you know, what is the choice that we have to make a decision about there that is going to actually allow us to start addressing the operational cognitive dissonance in the American population?
I think the American people feel today that the system isn't working for them. And I think they're largely right. I think what they have not internalized is that big government is invariably, primarily, a servant of the strong, of the organized, the educated, the affluent, the lawyered up. That's why Washington is what it is today.
And that's why we get Medicaid prescription drugs first.
Exactly. The old law of concentrated benefits and dispersed costs, and it's a kind of constant shell game. Two-thirds of the federal budget today is transfer payments. So transfer payments are twice as big as everything else, the Marine Corps, the national parks, the FBI, everything. So everyone's on the take, as it were. And the challenge for conservatives, and the challenge particularly for libertarian-flavored conservatism, is to maneuver within the public's deeply conflicted desires. You talk about 2016. My first rule is I want a governor. I don't want any more senators. They've never run anything. They really believe in the magic of words. Scott Walker, Kasich, Mike Pence, Bobby Jindal. People have actually had to run things and had people, clamorous people in their outer office. The American people are now living with, and more comfortable than they want to admit, a big state. And we're not going back. We're just not. I'd like to go back to what Albert J. Nock wanted, but we're not going.
By the same token, you've talked about kind of economic determinism or the idea that people think that the way things are going now is the only way they can go. And in fact, in various periods in American history, that just radically changes. Medicare at this point, and if you throw in Social Security as well, I mean, we're in a death spiral. Are there ways to pull out of that that are not going to be so disruptive as to cause even more social upheaval?
President Obama says to Paul Ryan, Paul Ryan would end Medicare as we know it. Arithmetic will end Medicare as we know it. This is not a surprise and it's not optional. It's going to end. The question is, then what do we do? Then what? Yamamoto's question again. So Republicans have to be ready as the crisis nears. I don't want to sound like this conservative Marxism. The internal contradictions become insupportable.
Yeah, you have in the Goldwater preface, you talk a lot about a kind of dialectic.
Yeah.
Do you see, in a sense then, and this might bring it back to the concept of a libertarian moment, that what we're seeing now is the dialectic shifting away from a kind of expansive government across all ideologies to its opposite.
Right. In part because, and I come back to the technological part, people are conditioned by their daily experience, going to Starbucks, going on the internet, to the sense of empowerment. And the idea that some people here in Washington are going to fix 18% of the economy that's the healthcare system by writing rules and regulations just strikes young people as weird. Just doesn't make any sense. And that's a sea change.
Can we perhaps wrap things up by you telling us how Everett Dirksen's untimely death changed George Will's life?
Well, I was teaching at the University of Toronto. I was 2 years out of Princeton Graduate School. And in the fall of 1969, Everett Dirksen died. Great state of Illinois, where I am from. And Dirksen had been the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, and so they had to vote and shuffle the leadership, and a Colorado Republican, Gordon Allott, of whom I'd never heard, became third-ranking Republican chairman of the policy committee. He said to one of his staff, I would like to hire a Republican academic to write for me. It was 1969. There were no Republican academics except me, and I was in Canada. Through serendipity, a guy at the University of Denver who'd been in graduate school at Princeton with me said to Gordon Allott, I know a guy who's really weird conservative. And so they got me down here. So if Dirksen had lived a few years longer, I would have got tenure and be teaching somewhere.
Do you regret moving back down into the United States at this point?
No. I'm a hopeless nationalist and would want to live here. I've had just a wonderful time in Washington. I think Colette, the short novelist, said at the end of her life, she said, I've had a wonderful life. I just wish I'd realized it at the time. Well, I'm having a wonderful time in Washington. I realize it every day because in part I owe my current happiness to Barack Obama, who is so aggressively progressive. So thoroughly concentrates all the American progressive tradition and the academic culture that goes with it, that he's really put the spring in my step, just in opposition.
You had a great line earlier this year, I think it was, that the modern liberalism, the whole point of it is to make people feel good about themselves, which struck me as being kind of true. Do you feel like that's kind of the epitome of Obamaism and the way that politics have been waged, and in fact, the way the 2012 election was sort of actually fought over as opposed to the actual issues?
Yeah, we now have a lot of data. They say it's anecdotal. Moynihan said the plural of anecdote is data about affirmative action. We know it's really not helping people. It's really hurting a lot of people. The way we're administering it doesn't matter to the advocates of affirmative action because the point of affirmative action is to make them feel good. It's to make the elite.
Make the administrators of affirmative action feel good?
Make elite universities feel virtuous. And the fact that, there's abundant evidence that, for example, the way the major law schools, the elite law schools in California, are administering affirmative action is reducing the number of African-American lawyers in California. Don't care, because that's not what this is about. It's about feeling good. It even seeps over into foreign policy. I mean, the reason we went to war in, or at least over Libya, that made us feel good. It was a moral gesture with high explosives that And then we packed up and went home, except for the people we left in Benghazi.
In terms of kind of racial questions or racial dynamics in America, you recently, or you're fond of actually pointing out how when Daniel Moynihan wrote the Moynihan Report, what was the level of illegitimate births?
23.7%.
Right, and now it's
72
for black Americans. Here's a question for you in, related to policy. You know, it's also much higher among white births, all births. It doesn't seem like anything, it's ever gonna go back down, you know, to what it was in the 60s, when
it
was considered. How do you affect that? And this might be
a
question of statecraft and soulcraft.
It's a good question because we don't know what caused this. We've seen family disintegration in war, famine, pestilence. This happened in peacetime. In prosperity, we've seen this sea change of mores. I don't know what caused it. And until you know what caused it, it's hard to know how you address it. But what we're seeing and what Charles Murray addresses in his book, Coming Apart, is a dangerous bifurcation of American society, wherein sort of traditional bourgeois morality, norms of marriage and family, obtain among the high achievers. And because the family is the primary transmitter of social capital, they will continue to reproduce themselves. Whereas down lower, these norms among the people who most need the accumulated social capital that a family represents are doing the most damage to the family. And I think Charles Murray says that he wishes that the upper classes, those who set the cultural tone of the country, would preach what they practice. I think there are corrective mechanisms in society. You know, there was a great problem in 18th century London when the surplus of grain and the in the Western world, combined with the new art of distilling, and it produced gin, and it produced the London of Hogarth, terrible ravages, social costs of alcohol. Well, the government did licensing laws, closed the pubs a little bit, that didn't what changed it. What changed it was John Wesley. John Wesley gave 30,000 sermons, and he converted the women of England, and the women brought the men to heal, and England healed. And pretty soon you had the Victorian era. Things were different. So things can change, but it's largely cultural ferment. I don't get into Marx and language here, but politics can be an epiphenomenon.
One hopes that it is, because otherwise we're totally screwed.
Well, it's epiphenomenal often, but not always.
We talked a lot about things that are kind of trending in a bad direction. Are you optimistic still, despite everything?
Yeah, I think so. Because the American premises are quite correct, and the American capacity for renewal is real. We live in a city here in Washington that was segregated 40 years ago. I mean, look at the change in this country. Breathtaking, take just shocking behavior that was normal. The routine daily insulting of African Americans by white Americans, now completely unacceptable. That's astonishing improvement. And laws, here I have to say to my libertarian friends, laws mattered here.
Goldwater is the one who said, that you can change the laws, but you can't make me love my neighbor. Yeah. But in fact, he's probably wrong about that.
That's right. And to which the answer was A, you'd be surprised, and B, even if you can't love him, you can sit at the lunch counter with him and say, pass the sugar. And you do that enough, things change. And they did. So the plasticity of America is still wonderful. You know, you look at all the valedictorians in California High School named Rodriguez and Nguyen. The premises are right. And a final word about the capacity for renewal. we have a wonderfully retrospective cast to our politics. We always look back to the basic documents, the Declaration and the Constitution, the best, most renewing thing that's happened in America in the last 4 or 5 years, called the Tea Party. It's named after something that happened in 1773, for Pete's sake. I mean, it's a very healthy, the way we go through life with a crick in our neck from looking back at our origins, which are in a doctrine of limited, delegated, and enumerated powers for the government. And that's why I'm confident.
And I think we will leave it there. Thank you so much for talking at length with us. George Will, talking with Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. Thanks very much.